Hi, my name is Bo Arfi, and this is Uncommon.
Uncommon is a production focused on the why of business, media, and marketing. It's made by my team at Neural, a digital agency for challenger brands and talent. To learn more, just visit neural.com. That's N-E-U-R-A-L-L-E.com. All right, my guest this week is Bo Arfi, CEO of Maple Property Group, owner of 20 properties by 27. Thanks for coming in. How did you meet Leo?
I actually met him at a book launch going back, 3 or 4 years ago.
What was the book?
His own book. So when he wrote it, yeah, I actually attended. I didn't know him either. Right. I just had followed him for a while. I'd watched what he'd done and basically, just came along. And I think we'd spoken a little bit back and forth on Instagram and just made myself known and went down to support him. And from that point became good friends.
When did you start seeing Leo and following his stuff?
A while ago. I remember he'd do lives and there was only, there'd be 3 or 4 people viewing and I'd be one of them cheering him on. And I just thought he was cool. I loved what he was doing. I loved his confidence and he was awesome. I mean, even when he was getting started, he was, he had an office in near Chadston. He was awesome. He was a good person to pick his brain, very knowledgeable and wise beyond his years. So we hit it off.
Which part of Melbourne did you grow up in? Similar era?
No, I was in the northern suburbs. So I grew up in kind of like just before Doreen at Yarrambat, it's called.
Yeah. Well, what's sort of like your earliest inception memory? Was it the earliest thing you can remember?
Like ever?
Yeah.
Probably when I was, I was playing Crazy Bones when I was younger. In primary
Holy
school.
Shit.
And I remember I was playing for keeps and I had like this wicked collection because it's all just by chance. And I was, been prep or something. And I think I was versing like a grade 6 and we were playing for keeps. And this guy, like he was, because you'd flick your bones and try and hit the other guys. And I remember he'd hit like my prized possession. And I pretty much just picked it up and ran off and started crying. So, but that's my earliest. That's all I remember.
So he was in year 6. What year would you have been in at the time?
Oh, I was in prep. So
no shit.
Yeah.
And you were playing. What the fuck?
Yeah.
Where's the balls on you to be playing a year 6 kid?
That's a good question. Yeah. I don't know.
People, obviously Leif will link a lot of this stuff. The moment you said that, I was like, that's a memory unlocked. I've completely forgot about Crazy Bones. These crazy fucking looking things.
Yeah, exactly. And I remember Beyblades as well.
Yeah, Beyblades are like a very distinct thing that I'm pretty sure everyone had. But like no one has ever brought up this at all, Crazy Bones.
That's a good point, yeah.
Like I remember having these. Holy fuck. Like the pink ones.
I might lock something in your heart.
Dude, what was like, do you remember the color or the one that was like your prized possession?
Oh, yeah. It was Sharky and it was like kind of see-through. It was like a white kind of see-through.
Okay.
Yeah.
So white, Sharky, see-through.
Yeah, Sharky.
Sharky.
Something special. Yeah.
Sharky, white. That's so funny.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, he was my favorite. There's so many of them, I just don't remember their names. And then
look at the ghost ones as well.
That's all Sharky. Look at all those colors.
Yeah. So that was one of mine.
That's like one because you could get like a silvery glittery thing. You see that one on the right?
Yeah, I reckon mine was that see-through one.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
So this person has clearly got a major collection. Yeah. I'm pretty sure I had that sort of metallic-y black looking one.
Yeah.
So there's like 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, like. There's easily 30 variations of this thing here.
Yeah.
It's fucking wild. How much did this shit cost? I got to ask my mum.
I'm not sure. Didn't buy it.
So what, growing up, was there any, like what did your parents do for work?
So my parents actually split up when I was quite young.
Yeah, right.
My grandfather, my nonno made shoes. He had a shoe factory in Brunswick. My dad worked with him more or less when I was younger. And then my mom had a skincare company. She, yeah, basically it's like skincare, but it's also like for babies as well. My dad worked with her a little bit, and then my parents essentially broke up when I was like 11 or 12 years old. My dad lives in Thailand ever since, and basically, yeah, kind of does his own thing over there. Does do a bit of real estate over there, but yeah, my mum's got her own business.
And she's still got the skincare business?
Yeah, she's still got the company.
Wow.
Yeah, so she's had it close to 30 years.
So you'd say that like the idea of having your own business was sort of instilled at a reasonably early age?
Yeah, I'd say so. I think, you know, I obviously knew it was hard work, but, you know, it can be rewarding. But yeah, certainly I think, yeah, it was certainly something that I saw and, you know, wanted to have maybe in a subconscious way.
What did you think you were going to be as a kid?
When I was, even in high school, like probably till I was about 18, I thought I'd be like a personal trainer or something. I love sport, like played football all the way through from 10 years old to 18. Loved it. So yeah, sort of thought I'd do something in sports. Yeah.
And like talk me through the whole property thing, I guess, in the notes here was quite interesting looking back at it, and that, so you finish high school, you're working as a dishwasher at a restaurant.
Yeah.
You went to the, I think it was the Arnie self-development.
That's right.
Course at like 18 and a half.
Yep.
And when were you 18? What year?
Oh, I don't know what year, maybe 2012. Yeah.
Okay, so
that's
yeah.
I graduated. Yeah,
2012 is when you began the property journey. So that was pretty quick, it
2013
seems.
2013 would have been when I.
When you first bought, right?
Yeah.
19?
Yeah, 19. Yeah. I think
That's pretty fucking quick.
Yeah. I think I bought late into 19, and I think I settled it when I was 20. So I think I bought it on like a 6 month settlement or something.
Yeah. Right. Do you think was like the instigator in the interest in property? Do you think it was doing that self-development conference, or was it that you were just like, you did this conference, you understood that you need to be doing something else other than washing dishes, and the thing that you found was property?
Yeah, for me, like I had a family friend that was involved in property. And what I noticed like very young is like that everybody who was in property over time did well. Like they had money. And even like stupid people, like I'm not going to name names, but I've worked for real estate agencies and I've worked in property management at a handful of different companies ever since I was 19 years old, I should say. And I would see things where, you know, people would, you know, I worked for a company where the director once upon a time had 1,500 properties on their books. And then when I worked there, they only had like 300 properties on their books. I'm like, what the heck happened to it? I didn't know if they'd sold it or whatever. But I did realize that, and this is, I would have been 19 years old, so I had no idea how they run their business. But I remember the director drove a Bentley and his wife drove like some Maserati four-wheel drive or something of that nature. I don't remember. I remember he drove a Bentley though. And I'm like, what the heck? And then I remember hearing like that her dad was very big in property and that, you know, and they'd done some stuff. And I was like, every person in my life that I knew who was involved in property, who was a bit older, had done well. And for me, I was like, well, I want to do well. And, you know, I thought like, you know, over time I'm seeing all of these people. Because I observe a lot. Like I'm like, if I see somebody who's got something that I might want to have, I'm like, oh, how did they get that? And then, you know, if I'm trying to decide which direction I want to go, and I see that people with property look like they are, you know, they have more resources financially, then I'm going to go, you know, being 19, I'm going to gravitate towards roles and things where I can essentially associate myself to that field that I essentially feel like is more lucrative in a sense. So I had a family friend who was also a developer, which I didn't really understand what that was when I was that age as well. And similar sort of thing. I mean, he was always on holidays. He was always having a good time. He had a great relationship with his wife. His kids were great. Like, and, you know, not to say like my family was also great, but at the same time, like we had different struggles. Like we had struggles around, you know, like often I would worry, you know, are we going to have food on the table, but can we pay our bills? You know, is the mortgage going to be paid for? Do we have enough orders coming through? Like all of these things I would hear very young. And, so, you know, when you have a single mother who you sort of see have their ups and downs, I mean, nobody wants to see like their mother struggle as well. That probably is one thing that like made me work very hard in the sense, not that I've like helped her out or anything too much just yet, and I would love to. But essentially, you know, I do what I can for her, and, you know, that's basically, like, I think that instills some sort of hunger. And also, like, she's had the business, and also seeing property as something that is lucrative, it kind of was a recipe for me to kind of think that property is a good avenue to go down.
Yeah.
So just seeing people, you know.
So a bit of pattern matching as a kid at that age.
Exactly.
Pushes you down that path.
Completely.
And
yeah.
So you worked at a mortgage broker.
Yeah.
Well, actually, it seems like you worked in a bunch of different angles. So, like, mortgage brokering, property management, and then sales, right? So that's sort of like the would that be, I guess building would be the other one, but they're sort of the four main functions that exist within the property industry.
Yeah, pretty much. Like, my first role in the whole industry was property management. So I was at university, and while I was at, so I was actually first thing, I like finished school, dishwasher, worked there for a bit. Then basically, like, I was at uni, like, doing my first year, TAFE, I should say. It was like a pathway progression thing. And then essentially, I would, to go into my second year of, like, when I was going through, about to go through my second year of uni, I actually scored a job working in property management.
Okay.
4 days a week, 3 days during the weeks. And then 1 day was a Saturday for the open for inspections. Did that for about 9 months, and then got a job. So that was real estate. That was, like, property management. And then I got a job for a company that's very big in the industry that I work at now. I would have been, like, 20 years old or something. And in that, at that company, like, I did a bit of, I was exposed to, like, a range of different things. Like, I would see, I would, like, call people. So basically people would, like, get free books, whether that's like these hard copy books, and people that would be, like, all about different types of investing, like commercial, residential, like, whatever. And basically I'd call people up and be like, oh, hey, like, you got this book, like, and basically just, like, have a, book them in for a conversation. Then I'd speak to them on the phone. Then I'd speak to them in person, basically, you know, try and, you know, see if investing was something that they wanted to do, similar like a buyer's advocacy company.
Right.
And then basically helped with, and then I would connect them with mortgage brokers very young through this company. So,
right.
So I did that for a while, like, close to a year. And that obviously wasn't real estate, but that was sort of like a buyer's agency company that connected with the broker very closely. And then after that, I worked in financial planning, worked for a company that, where I essentially would sit with people. And at this point, we would no longer just be looking at property. We would look at their whole situation. So we had like 7 areas of advice that we'd support people with when I worked at this company. And basically things such as like tax, debt reduction, insurances, direct asset, getting into property, other things. I think we did like ETFs and stuff like that. So we did a little bit of that. I was there for a while. I met a lot of really good friends there and a lot of those guys, later story, but I met my best friend in that company. And then him and I started a company together, actually. And then, which is basically similar to what I do now, but then we both went and did our own thing.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
And I think this is probably an important distinction in Maple Property Group, at least seems to be an advisory business to people in this domain, whereas your investments are totally separate, right?
Yeah, completely. Like my own personal investing is something that, you know, I've done from a very young age. Maple Property just stems from my belief that property is a great asset class. It's bricks and mortar. For me, like I have like other forms of assets as well. Like obviously I have, NFTs and crypto and shares and like I'm involved in all of the above. But for me, like property is like, I feel like that's really where you create your like your real wealth. For me, my goal is always like creating equity and using the equity to duplicate. And it wasn't necessarily like, obviously cash flow is really important, but for me, like I wanted to just increase my knowledge, build up my equity, and then basically like equities options. It's like access to cheap capital, not as cheap at the moment, but it's usually access to cheap capital. So if you can tap into your equity, then you can essentially do what you want with it. And you can afford to eventually do something that's make stupid decisions or make really good decisions and then make stupid decisions or whatever. So my plan was always to use property and use residential property more as a stepping stone to be able to get, to invest in property safely and securely, but also build up my equity so that I could take that equity and then do something that I think could be more aggressive and more assertive and do something else where, you know, that might be like investing in property or investing in commercial or whatnot. So for me, you know, an example of that is, you know, three stupid decisions that I've probably made with property through equity is three of my offices just across the road from here. You know, I didn't need to buy a $950,000 office, but I wanted to. So, you know, I could have made that return work harder elsewhere, but I didn't care. So essentially, you know, when you build up equity, you can essentially decide if you want to, you know, make smart decisions and keep kind of going down that trajectory of what you want, or you can kind of, you can go a different way essentially.
So when you say it was a bad decision, is that because you look at it in comparison to where the retail market went?
Completely. Well, I mean, like if I bought an office, I imagine what I could have done if I didn't. I mean, I bought two other offices in the same building too, which I hardly use really. So, and I haven't bothered to rent them out either. So, and I could, but the thing is, I mean, if I put that money, like if you count up all those three of those offices, two of them are unencumbered. And the new one is like, I had to put like a 35% deposit down. So there's massive opportunity cost that I've put into this. So if I decided to put that, you know, $1.4 million into something else, I mean, I could have exponentially grown that much further, whether I put, you know, three investment properties that, you know, were going to grow at 7 or 8% a year over time, not year on year, because property is a long-term game. But essentially, I could have got a much better return by essentially, you know, continuing to invest. But for me, I was like, I didn't really need to have like 500 properties. I'm like, look, I've been investing very hard and very aggressively for what I feel like is a long time. I mean, I just turned 28, but if I bought my first one at 19, I mean, that's 9 years. That's 9 years of sacrifice too. I mean, like I was never one. I mean, when I was 25, I bought a Mercedes. But then I sold that 18 months later to then buy two more properties. So like for me, I feel like I'd sacrifice for a really long time and basically, you know, I'm still happy to do so, but I wanted to reward myself a little bit. So
when did you buy it?
The office?
Yeah.
Well, I put the offer down in December 2021. Yeah. And settled on it probably going back 3 months ago.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So recent. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
So all that time, that's my big stupid thing I've done. I also bought my own home. We've got a penthouse in Bulleen.
Yeah.
And that's probably the other thing that I did. I did both of those things. I bought more properties than I ever bought actually in the last 12 months. So.
Right.
Yeah.
Why was, do you say that you feel that the Bulleen one was a silly financial decision?
Absolutely.
Why?
But I wanted it. Well, it's not that it's a silly financial decision, that it was an emotional decision. So same sort of thing. I mean, it was an apartment. You know, it's a $600,000 apartment. Thankfully, it's gone up. It's worth a lot more. But it was an emotional decision. It wasn't one where I was trying to make heaps of money off it, essentially. So it's not a dumb decision, but it's an emotional decision.
Yeah.
It's one that, and when you go from a mindset of only caring about portfolio growth for so many years and only thinking about duplicating, I mean, I would put myself under immense stress, like that. It's like, it's not fun. Like, it's like, you know, I would settle on properties. Like I would put down $150,000 on a property as an example, not be that sure where I'm getting it from, like sort of have the money, have like 90 grand and then like know that some's coming in and then try and take some equity out. And like, if it was a good deal, I'd just do it. But then I'd settle the property. I'd give the person the 150 and I'd have like $300 in the bank account.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like there's-
I remember you posted something like, about settling on your recent office and you had like maybe $180 or a grand or something.
My current?
Yeah.
Yeah. That was my, so the one before the current. Yeah. So I've got this one, 150K or something. It was like 57 squares or something.
Yeah. Right.
And I bought that. I bought that outright, which was- didn't need to do that either. Dumb. 150K. I could have put that in a bunch of things. But I just did it. I mean, that's again, and I only had a little bit left after that. So that would have been in 2021 or something. Yeah.
Yeah. What do you
like? 150K. Yeah.
What do you like when it comes to doing like your personal budget? Like I've got like a full on spreadsheet and everything. And I love measuring everything. Yeah. Are you that type of person?
For me, like I certainly like I'm big on budgeting and that sort of thing, but for me, like, I've always been like, it was always like, I'd just buy it and work it out later. And that was like, again, like, I don't recommend that at all. At Maple, we're very, very different though. I mean, I also, like, I hire people who've got much more experience than me. I mean, my senior consultants that work for me, you know, some of them have got 20 years, 25 years experience. They've been doing this for a really long time. They love the data. They love the statistics. They get right into it. For me, obviously, I love all that stuff too. But for me, I'm a value for money guy. I'm in there like negotiating. I'm looking for the properties. Like, I'm trying to, like, I do a lot of that stuff. And yeah, my role is sort of more centered around that. And for me, like, I like value for money. Like, I'll never knock a property. Like, whether it's a commercial property, a retail property, an established property, a new property, an off the plan property, like, whatever it is, like, car park, whatever. Like, I have all of those properties. Like, and I won't say like, oh, this one's shit and that one's shit. And that's the thing that I hated about like working for other companies is like, when I worked for other companies, they would often be like, oh, you want to buy a car park? Like, that's stupid. Like, do you know, like, you should buy what we think you should buy? And it's like, shut the fuck up. Like, I want to buy what I want to buy. And like,
yeah,
it makes sense to me. So, so yeah, basically I feel like, you know, you shouldn't essentially knock anything. You know, I got car parks, I got commercial property, I got the offices and residential.
If it's a good deal, it's a good deal.
If it's a good deal, it's a good deal. Exactly. So,
right.
You know, it's like, if something was like 6 hours away, I'm be like, oh, fuck that. I'm not buying there. Like, if it's $100,000 and it's going to give me like $450 a week, I'm going to be like, okay, how solid is this $450 a week? Like, can I rely on it? Like, is this relatively guaranteed? Like, what deposit do I need to put down? Like, what's the risk associated? What's the vacancy rate? Like, is it easy to get a tenant? Like, all this stuff. Like, and if it makes sense, it makes sense.
Mm.
So I wouldn't really knock any strategy in particular.
God, I've got so many questions for you. Yeah. I'm curious on where you sit on property type. So I'll give you my situation and why this is contextually relevant for me, and that
yeah.
I was having a conversation probably 6 weeks ago, and this person was talking down apartments, and I was like, I kind of get what you mean because I've lived in apartments and I understand the frustrations of it, but like, I also think like that viewpoint is very short term, and that the viewpoint was, okay, you know, apartments, they don't own land, it's in a body corp, blah, mm-hmm. blah, blah. They're not going to appreciate as much as houses, et cetera. But I'm like, but if that's what you can afford and that's good, it's a good deal, isn't that a good thing? Like, you're still getting into the property market. I just thought that was a weird perspective to have. So I guess I'm curious on where you sit on that side of things. And it's important now because of what happened with COVID.
Yeah.
I actually look at apartments and go, like, it's actually quite a good deal because they've been devalued significantly in comparison to houses. Like, the demand is for houses. So what's your view on it?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, for me, it's completely situational. You know, I wouldn't, you know, what that person said is it has some merit. I mean, at the same time, I mean, I got my current property, which is an apartment that I live in, and I own two apartments. And one of them, well, the one I live in at the moment, it's worth about $750,000. I only bought it probably 9 months ago, and I only bought it for $590,000. So, I mean, that's gone up quite a lot. I've had it appraised at that level. Whether that is true, I believe it is somewhat. Say. Yeah, exactly. The market will dictate it. And I have an apartment in the city. It's a 2-bedroom apartment in South Bank. Again, emotional decision. For me, whenever I make an emotional decision, it doesn't go as well for me financially. I bought my fourth property that I bought when I would have been 21, 22. I bought an apartment in South Bank, 2-bedroom. And that was, I bought that for $350,000, $355,000. And today that property is probably worth $450,000. But I'm 28 years old. So I bought that 7 years ago.
Still pretty good.
Yeah, I suppose.
I mean,
look, it's okay. Yeah.
I guess the thing is comparing it to inflation, right?
That's true. So to answer your question directly, my sort of like thinking and my rule is essentially that like the best time to get into the market is when you can afford it.
Yeah.
Like, I think the absolute worst thing that anybody can do is like wait for things to happen. Like, like nobody has a crystal ball.
The perfect opportunity or the perfect price.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Because what you think about it, like once you get in, like even if the property grows at 0%, yeah, for like a year or two, like say you fuck up completely and you've bought at the wrong time. Yeah. Property's a long-term game. So we're not trying to like you know, for me, like I don't like flip and stuff like that. Like I've never sold a property. So like, even if the market doesn't move for 2 years, right, you're going to hold the property for more than 2 years. So then if you have a look at what else is associated to buying a property, well, what have you got? You've got cash flow, and the properties that I've purchased have always been positive cash flow. So if you go, all right, if you can find a property that's $100 a month positive cash flow, then over 12 months, you got $1,200. $1,200 positive cash flow for the year. Okay, cool. That's fuck all. That's fine. $1,200. What's the next one? Maybe tax. Call it, you know, the tax that you might get back off a property if it's positively cash flowed, negatively geared, or however you structure it, really. All your expenses associated to a property, they're going to be tax deductible. So say you get $3,000 or $4,000 back. Say call it $3,500. You got $3,500 plus $1,200. You're $4,700 better off already. The next thing is maybe debt reduction. If you structure the property, you don't have to structure it on P&I, but if you structure it on P&I, then that property is going to pay for itself off roughly about $7,000 a year, between $7,000 and $8,000 a year. So if you go $8,000 a year plus $4,700, what's that? $12,700. So $12,700 better off without even calculating growth to do that. So
still pretty good.
It's still pretty good. I mean, my answer is $12,500. $12,700 is better than nothing.
Yeah.
You know, so you could stuff
versus,
up.
Versus sitting in a bank.
Correct. And then you've got inflation, and is inflation, your purchasing power is going down. I mean, if you've got $100,000 in the bank, and then every single year, I mean, inflation, what, it was 7% or something?
Yeah.
7%. So $100,000. And then if you hold that in there for 12 months, your purchasing power is going to go down $7,000. Right. When I was 25, I bought my Mercedes. It was $56,000, brand new, right? C300, Mercedes, perfect, good car, right? Had 2,000 Ks on it, something like that. So it wasn't brand new. I was looking at getting the same thing recently, brand new, $104,500.
Jesus.
Same car, three years down the track, new and new.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think that inflation is more than 7%. I think it's very dangerous to just keep your money in the bank.
Well, it's a different time. It's like supply-driven inflation.
Yeah.
More than just money-printed inflation. So it stings even more at the moment. That's why it's really hard to compare where we are right now to anything that we had prior.
Yeah.
So it's different.
Yeah.
It's
very different. Spoke with a guy yesterday. He goes, he bought a Hilux or something like 3 years ago. And he goes, I bought it for $50,000. I'm getting offers. He got an offer the other day, 76K.
Jeez.
So he's drove it for 3 years. He bought it for like $50,000, and now he's got 76K offer.
The thing, though, in that situation is he's going to need to buy a car anyway.
That's fair. Yeah.
Similar thing. My in-laws, so we got a Skoda sort of.
But 90K is not going to be 90K. That's my point.
Yeah.
Like 90K sounds like a lot of money, but like if everything goes up, like if all the used cars are then 110K, like your 90K is fuck all. So even if like the market doesn't go up, it's like you're still losing that money.
Yeah.
It's like it's like, what are you worth? It's like you're almost storing your money now.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like in Asia, it's like, or in China, like you can't, people just store their money. It's like they, you know, all their properties are leaseholds. So they're like, they have to, they store their money in like wine barrels and shit, like art, whiskey, like whatever. So it's almost like if inflation's going to be like ridiculous, it's like, it's almost.
Yeah, hard physical assets are going to be the thing. Mm. Or anything that is hard asset in comparison to its dollar value. So cars, houses, gold, NFTs, crypto, a business.
Mm.
Yeah,
definitely.
Because it's the only thing that's going to be able to fight the inflation side of things.
Completely.
So
lettuce is $12.
lettuces. That's wild. Is like if you go as well to the market at the moment and you look at the prices, obviously things are up big time, I think. When I look at how much we were spending on groceries, it's easily like 30-40% up.
Yep.
But again, a lot of that's supply driven because we're so used to the fact that we just eat whatever we want all year round as opposed to just eating seasonally, which I found really interesting. If you look at a lot of the seasonal vegetables, they're not up as much.
Mm.
Like if you want to eat potatoes and broccoli and carrots and Brussels sprouts and all that, it's actually reasonably well priced.
Yeah, okay.
But if you want tomato,
yeah,
it's going to taste like nothing. And also, by the way, you're paying $13-14 a kilo. So,
unreal.
Yeah. That was just at least an interesting observation I found.
Completely.
So, talk to me about Maple Property Group. You got 27 staff listed on the website. I'm sure that's probably changed in some way.
Always changing.
Yeah.
Always changing.
I always find it's funny when you do that and then you like you have new staff, people leave, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, I got new people coming in. We've got like 7 or 8 new people, but 4 people have left. And then, it's like ridiculous. It's changing all the time. It's like, internally people are like, what the heck? You know, and I'm like almost going to get rid of it at this point.
It is what it is.
Correct.
So what is it that you think that you guys do different?
So for us, like, I mean, I always worked for other companies that did this sort of thing and some of the biggest companies in the industry for this sort of stuff. So for me, there was a magnitude of things that I really didn't like about it, about other companies that I worked for. And I tried to adopt that and put that into my company's practice. So I give you some examples are essentially, the education process. So our education process is designed for people that, yes, they want to be aggressive, but they also want to learn. And they want to question things and they want to query things and they want to be inquisitive and they don't want to just go, oh, hey, yeah, tell me what to buy and I'll buy it. Like, we don't really work like that. We want to, like, this is a long-term kind of partnership that we want to have with people. So a lot of other companies, I've seen them basically just go bring them on board and then essentially do like one session with them and then present something to them and go, hey, do you want to buy it? Yes, no. If you don't want to buy it, move along, never hear from them again. That's the first thing. And that's something that like we're very different with. We do like 4 in-depth like education and strategy sessions that, you know, we'll do before we even get to the point of presenting something to them. So our education and strategy sessions are a lot longer. And, you know, we would work with the client. We value the person that we work with, I feel like, a lot more because all of our business, essentially, this is a second thing, like all of our business pretty much comes from like word of mouth, repeat business, referrals, it comes from our socials. Like often it's pretty much unpaid. Like we've never really done too much paid things. Like we've done like little things here and there, but it's like not part of our overall strategy. Mm. So, I mean, that's the second thing. Like I've worked for companies that have got like that have like 15 people like cold calling in a room to then get an appointment, to then book it in, to then have a 3% chance of closing.
Yeah.
Like for us, we get like a website inquiry and we might get, 20 a week or something. And we get these website inquiries and our business just completely comes from different ways. And we're almost like a real estate agency in the sense that we try and be out there. You know, we encourage people to speak to their friends and family and we very much like wear our reputation. And if we like stuff up, like then we have to like, we wear it and like, you know, stuff up might be like not communicating to a customer for 3 days, like, or something like that. Like we have to wear that, but we're very public in like what we do. We're not like this kind of hidden company. Like I've worked for companies that have got 3 or 4 businesses where the cold call company is calling saying they're from one company, then they'll give it to another company that basically like will do the warm up and then they'll give it to like another company. And then all of a sudden, like these two companies will have like all shit reviews. And then this one company has got like glowing reviews. I'm like, it's the same company. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So like, we don't do any of that stuff really. And like,
it sounds like the advantage definitely is service based. And that
pretty much
you consider what your competitors are doing. They've got a one-time sit down and that's it. Whereas yours is very in depth and you're banking on that service as being that advantage.
Yeah, I think so. We want to like out-service people, but we also want to be here for a long time. Like for me, it's not about like just making money for us. It's about like reputation. Like that's something that I care about like a lot more. If people are saying like bad things about the company, that is like 100 times more concerning than people like deciding that it's not the right time to purchase or holding off their finance or something like that. Like, for me, like the reputation is like, the most important thing.
Okay. Yeah. What are the core tenets and principles that you talk about a lot? You mentioned it before is the idea and it's covered on the website about usable equity. So this would sort of define a lot of the strategy that you talk about with clients. Yeah. Walk us through what that idea is and why it's important.
Well, there's a statistic out there that it's something like 93% of the population essentially don't have an investment property. They've got their own home. And then 7% or thereabouts have got an investment property and their own home. And then of those 7% or of, the whole population, only 0.5% have got 3 or more investment properties as well as their own home. So then you have to ask yourself why. The reason why is not because of, it's not because it's like asset, like they're asset rich. Like you can have heaps of equity and then not be able to duplicate, which is a massive problem too. So it comes down to cash flow. So there's usable equity, and then you have to have good cash flow as well. So the way that usable equity works is essentially you've got the value of the property. So 500K property, 80% of that minus the debt. So if you've got a 500K property, say your debt is 300K, then 80% of $500,000 is $400,000 less your debt of $300,000. Your usable equity is $100,000. Okay. So you can use $100,000 to buy a property. Gotcha. Now, obviously, there's a bunch of caveats to that and the bank has to allow it and yada, yada. But from the equity side of it, that's typically the rule.
Interesting.
So yeah, I mean, it's good to know. And then you've got equity and then you've got usable equity.
Yeah. So you're essentially saying that usable equity, the distinct thing about that and why it's advantageous and why people may overlook it is that it gives you the opportunity for compound growth more than anything.
Yeah, completely. I mean, yeah, compound growth, but also like the ability to continue duplicating, which I think is like kind of even more important because say you buy a property, like this is how I look at it. This is how I got to 20 because like I'll look at a property and if a property could go up, say one property goes up 5% in value every year, but it only hurts my borrowing capacity 50K. But then another property goes up by 12% every year, but it hurts my borrowing capacity 500K because it's purely growth. Which one am I going to pick? I'm not going to pick the one that's going to go up 12%. I'm going to pick the one that goes up at 5% and hardly does anything to my borrowing capacity. Then it means I can keep moving and keep doing things.
Mm.
Now, not everybody wants to keep doing things. You know, some people are just happy to have one or two, pay it down, good growth, safe, perfect, good. And that's fine. That's what we can do as well. And people can obviously buy properties themselves, but you know, for us, like it's about like if you want to try and do more, then the traditional conventional way won't necessarily work. You'll get to two or three and you'll get stuck.
Right. So the idea of focusing on growth for the sake of growth is not the be all and end all. It's actually probably cash flow.
Depends on your goals. Yeah. If it depends on your goals and your risk profile and the magnitude of things. For me, it was the best way to get growth was actually to be able to continue duplicating in that kind of way. So it's almost like, yes, cash flows, growth is important, but it's like long-term growth. Because if you can only buy two properties and those two properties are going to grow at 12% every year, or you could have 20 properties that are all going to grow at 5% every year, I mean, the 5% ones are going to significantly outweigh it and they're going to pay down more debt and they're going to give you more of a tax income and they're going to give you way better cash flow. Mm-hmm. So it's like, it's just a way up. It's not like, it's not even, and I'm not even saying like I'm right. I'm just saying it's different. Like,
well, it's that was your strategy.
Correct. Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
That's what got you to 20 properties.
Exactly. And I got random things too. Like, I mean, I got like three or four car parks. I've got like, I got random things like, yeah. And, you know, my first six or seven properties are all residential. But yeah, it's just, there's no right particular way. I typically find that I like residential properties. I think that everybody needs a place to live.
Mm.
I think that from a risk perspective, it's, you know, it's got a relatively good risk balance. So, I mean, even now, like interest rates are going up, like everything's through the roof, yeah? What's happening to rents? Going up. My rates, my interest rates start going up. What do I say? All my rent's up $100 a week. Too bad.
Mm.
You know, I mean, look, that's like, that might sound bad, but at the end of the day, well, like.
It's also what it is.
It is what it is. I can do that. So, like, you know, people need a place to live. You know what I mean?
Talk to me on where that's probably the thing that a lot of people want to hear now. I mean,
and I can't put up $100 straight away, but you get what I mean. Like, there's legalities and stuff. But still, I mean, like, for the ones that I can, I will.
Yeah.
And the market is demanding far more rent.
Yeah.
Yeah. During times like this.
So let's talk about the market. So this will probably go out 2 weeks from now, you say? 2 weeks? It is July, it'll be August 2022. By August, we'll be into June, July, August, we'll be at the end of winter, right? So September.
Yeah, I'm good.
Isn't that the worst? you fucking drink tea and then you start. The worst is either choking on your fucking water or your own spit. I don't know if you've ever done that before.
I haven't done my own spit, but I've done water just then. It wasn't fun.
Fucking worse.
Yeah.
Okay. So September, October, it's going to be very interesting. It's spring. It's the busiest time of the year when it comes to house sales,
mm.
or at least listings, right? Yep. One, how do you see, well, let's just start with how do you see the market today in comparison to where it was 12 months ago?
Well, I guess the media has a massive play in it too. I mean, like this is, property is a situation where like, I mean, if the market's going to go up 20% in 1 year, I mean, it can't go up 20% the next year. Like that's a problem. If it went up another 20%, like there's an issue. Like properties are too expensive. Like when rates started going up, I was like, cool, like good. But like now, I mean, obviously it's getting a bit ridiculous and it's going to go up again. But you know, the first one, obviously after 12 years, I was like, okay, cool. That's good, I guess, because first one, I'm talking the 0.25, whatever. Now it's getting silly and it's obviously not good for the everyday person to have to spend more to maintain the property that they live in. But at the same time, I think like you cannot have a situation where the market goes up 20% and expect it to go up, you know, 7 or 8% even again. I mean, that's not normal. Mm. Property is a long-term thing. It's meant to double in value every 7 to 10 years. And if it's 10 years, so be it. So if it goes up 20% and pulls back 5% this year, I mean, it's not going to pull back that much further than that. I mean, maybe 10% or something, but and that depends on areas too. I mean, that's not a hard and fast rule. I mean, some markets might drop 20%, some markets might drop 5%, some markets might go up 3 or 4%. I mean, it completely depends. Mm. And at the end of the day, I mean, nobody has a crystal ball. I mean, I remember looking at 60 Minutes back, you know, I was seeing a girl like seven, 8 years ago or something. No, it was 6 years ago. And I remember sitting in the living room and they were saying that property prices were going to go down. This would have been, what, 6 years ago?
Yeah, six years ago would have been 2016.
So 2016, right? 2016, they were saying prices are going to go down 40%.
Remember that period?
I mean, like, see, it was on 60 Minutes. Like, if you look it up, and it's like, it was everywhere. And I was like, I don't know what they're basing that on. I was like, what? And everyone's like, oh, Bo, like, oh, you know, your three properties. You know, I'm like, yeah, okay. Like, I don't believe this shit. And look, obviously now the market's completely different, but I'm just saying, like, you can't necessarily like trust exactly what the media is going to say. Mm. Obviously the times are completely different. Where do I think? I think that people have to put their money somewhere, right? And you got shares, crypto, NFTs, property, money in the bank, really. Like there's only so many options. So, you know, and people always need a place to live as well. So I think residential won't be too bad.
Commercial will be rough.
I think so, but at the same time, at a regional, did well during COVID. I mean, everybody said during COVID, like property market's going to go down. So
I think commercial will depend probably on the areas and like this area. I don't know if you felt this when you bought, because we bought around the same time.
Yeah.
This building in particular that we're in was like devastated from COVID. So
100%, same.
The price was down like 50% on where it was 2 years prior.
Yeah.
So I think this building will be okay, but I think there'll be others like prime city real estate that will start to maybe feel it a bit now because 100%. they didn't move at all during COVID.
Yeah,
which 100%. To me was bizarre.
Yeah, it's strange.
One of the most bizarre things.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think, I think like property is a long-term game. I looked at property like even back in the day, like I looked at it as an inflation thing too. I was like, what? I'm just going to keep my like 50K in the bank and like not do anything with it. I'm like, I can put in shares, I can put in crypto, I can put in gold. Like there's only so many things, there's only somewhere I can put it. So like, you know, and for me, like what I loved was like, all right, the market went up 5%. Like say the market goes up 5% over like 10 years, which is considered shit. But even like, all right, say you don't want to buy in Victoria. Like there's other markets where you can buy. Like if you span it out over 10 years, you'll get a 5% return even now. And maybe you're coming in at a lower point. Great. You know, 5% of $500,000 is 25K a year. Mm. I mean, you're getting 50% back on your money every year, essentially. You're buying that property with 50 grand. All right, fine. You got stamp duty and LMI and a few other things. So call it 70, whatever. But you're essentially getting between 30 and 50% of your return on spend back, even at a 5% return, because you're leveraging other people's money. So that's why I like property too, because you're leveraging 90% of the asset as well. Mm. Right. And obviously, like I live in a time where like properties have pretty much always went up and like last rate rise, I mean, I was 12 years ago. So I mean, I was young, but you know, at the same time, you have to put your money somewhere. Property is always going to be worth something. Mm. And every year you don't do something is also a time where you could potentially, you're missing out on that 12,700 that I mentioned, even if the property didn't go up, and you're also losing money. You're losing purchasing power. So, you know, there's, for me, I feel like there's only so many options.
Mm. So what would you say to someone who's, you know, 30-something like me?
Yeah.
I'm probably in a better situation because we've gotten this at a really good deal. You know, obviously you speak to people at the bank and see how much you can use of this towards a house or whatever. But houses are still at a level, at least of what we need, you know, 3 2-bedroom house. They're still at a level which is would stretch us. Where do you think, if we had the option between stretching ourselves with a residential house or a residential apartment to live in, what of the two would you be looking at if you can get a better deal on the apartment?
So is this for a place to live in?
Yep.
Well, for a place to live in, it's completely different. So if because now we're coming into things where I can't comment on how much you value an apartment versus and your lifestyle living versus the growth on a property.
Mm.
Like if we looked at it at face value and we're like, all right, well, what's going to grow more? Like probably a house, but that's not always true.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't say that's a hard and fast rule. So, I mean, you couldn't say with certainty. And also I can't put a value on, you know, how good that apartment is. I mean, if it's against buying an old established house, you know, just to have it there versus a brand new slick apartment and you can do it up and have your paintings on the wall and it looks great and you're secure, then, I mean, who am I to even say that that's not a good idea because that's an own home purchase. Mm. What we only work with investors, and that's a non-emotional purchase. For me, I mean, I own an apartment as well. I love it. Like I bought it knowing that like I wasn't going to grow. Like it wasn't going to grow that much, or I didn't care that much, or I just didn't have that much high expectations.
Interesting.
The fact that it grew, I was like, oh, wow, that's cool.
And you bought that because you just prefer living in an apartment.
I love the apartment. Yeah. Like I love it. Like I got 2 balconies, big balcony. I feel secure. Like, I love it. Like I can see the city skyline. I can like sit on the balcony and smoke a cigar and chill out. And I got a bench and I can do my work. Like I love it. Right. And if I was at a house, right, I'd be like, cool. Yeah. I got my backyard and stuff, but nah, for me, like I love an apartment. Like I've done it up. It's easy to keep tidy too. Like I'm hardly ever home. So like, it's, you know, I can't be like mowing the lawn and stuff all the time. And like, you know what I mean? So like,
yeah, I
love
it. I understand that.
Yeah. No, I love an apartment.
Yeah. For me, it's a hard one because, I'm not too wedded to the concept of like, I don't really give a shit about a backyard. The only thing I need is access to water on a balcony. Cause I've got like I've got bonsais. So I'm like really into bonsai.
Oh,
and my wife Lauren, she wants a dog, but the dog she wants is like a fucking little,
it's a little one
schnauzer.
You're all good.
Small, so
you're good with an apartment.
But it's just always dealing with like the parent. Like Jacob, you've recently purchased a property, and you know what this is like. It's the parents in your ear, and that you're having to deal with all the time. And like, what do you do?
Whose money is it?
Well, yeah, that's the thing.
Yeah.
So, okay, that's interesting.
Yeah.
What do you think you will be doing personally as an investor over the next 2 years? Will you be looking for good deals, or will you be looking to just personally maintain and see what happens?
See, for me, like 2 years feels like such a long time. Like if I'm like 2 years, I'm like, poor, I don't know what I'm 2 years. Like, so I think like, at the moment, like I've bought probably in the last 12 months, I bought more properties than I ever bought. I bought like 6 properties or something in the last like 12 months or something. So I still have a few things waiting to settle, waiting to title. Like I have properties that I bought. I have properties that I bought in the West that like in 2021, 2020, you know, that I've bought like land that's worth, you know, more than it is now. Like I bought land for $170,000 and it's worth $300,000 and things like that. So and then I've locked in construction prices as well, which I think they'll be too happy about, and they might try and get a bit funky with me. But basically, yeah, so essentially, like I've done a lot. So probably for the next, probably for the next 6 months, I'm relatively okay. But in saying that, I mean, I'm always looking on realestate.com domain and other platforms every night and speaking to people and comparing. So I mean, if for me, like it's value. I mean, if a good deal comes up, if a good opportunity comes up, and it makes sense, I'll consider my options and see what I can do. Mm. So my answer to that is, I mean, I'm not like sprinting at trying to get into the market, but I'm also not like hiding behind a blanket going like, I'm so terrified of what's going on. Like I don't want to touch anything. So it's like, it's a situation. And if you're sitting there with, like, you know, you haven't got into the market just yet and you're wondering if it's the right time, yada, yada, like, I mean, it's hard. You don't want to buy at the peak. And obviously there was a peak, but, you know, property is a long-term game as well. Yeah. So, I mean, the bank is the one who's taking on most of the risk too. I mean, they're the ones that's like, I mean, the bank lending money is like something too. Like the bank's funding 90% of the thing too.
Yeah.
And the bank's going to value the property. Like if the bank thinks that everything is going to like fall down and like turn into like the house of cards and like worth nothing, like we have a very strong like financial like institution of like it's not like America. You can't just like, oh yeah, like 2008, like, yeah, like give me like whatever, like that movie, The Big Short, that stripper had like six houses. Yeah. Like we can't do that. And we never could. Absolutely never could. So it was always very different. So the fact is that if you're able to buy a property, the valuations are coming in relatively close to what you're buying it for. And then like the bank's giving you the money. I mean, they're risking 90% of it, not you. Like, so, I mean, banks aren't dumb either. Like, I mean, if the bank's like, if you're buying a property and all the banks are valuing them like 100K under, you're like, all right, cool. Like there may be a problem. But if you buy a property like subject to finance and like the bank's valuing it at like what you're paying for it, like the bank's a lot smarter than all of us. Like they're also thinking like, oh, like you're paying a fair market price for it.
Yeah, yeah.
Like if they think a $500,000 property is going to go down to $400,000, they're not going to give you the money for it.
Yeah.
Or they're going to get a valuer to basically like
tell them otherwise
and value it horribly. Valuers can get sued. I think it was like 6 years ago or something, the first valuer like got sued. Valuers are conservative. Valuers are scared. Valuers are like, they're nervous. They always value like, they're always like valuing like under. Like, I mean, I got people, even my property that I bought in Bulleen, like it got valued at 570. And like 9 months later, someone's going to pay 750 for it. Yeah. And I got like a killer deal at 590. Like it shouldn't have been 590. Like comparables were at 650 at the time.
Yeah.
And they still valued it at 570. So like, I mean, the valuers are like nervous. So if you can get something on dollar, you're like, you're doing well.
Yeah, right. Interesting.
They can get in big trouble for like doing a evaluation that's not correct.
Maybe I need to go back to looking at apartments. Hey, Jacob, it's the one.
The best time you can get into the market is the best time to get in is when you can afford it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what I personally believe.
Yeah.
And if I was sitting on the sidelines and I hadn't invested yet and I had 50K and my 50K was dwindling away day by day, I would be desperate to go, what the fuck can I buy?
Yeah.
And I would almost not give a fuck. I'd be like, oh shit, I don't give a fuck if it's in Albury with Donga. I don't know. Like I would get something cheap and I'd be like, does it pay for itself? Can I leverage equity after a few years? Like, is it going to pay for itself down? Like, that's just me. I'm not saying like I'm right or wrong or anything. I obviously was very lucky. Like I'll be the first person to say, like I was able to live at home till I was 25 living at home, and then I had to start paying board at 25. Like I didn't have to pay board till I was 25.
Good
like,
Italian boy.
Absolutely, you know? And then I didn't move out till I was like 26 and a half. So, I mean, I had it good. Like that's my help from my parents. Like interesting. That helped me massively.
Yeah, right. That's lucky.
Like, I didn't get financial help, but I mean, that's very helpful. Not everybody has the luxury to stay at home till they're 26, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I moved out at 25, but I remember I was paying board from like 22. My parents were adamant about
pretty
it.
Pretty harsh.
Yeah.
That's just me. Yeah.
If someone's listening to this, thinking about, like, you've done a few of these interviews by now. You've sat down with Leo,
at different times. Yeah, definitely.
What's the biggest thing you want? Maybe it's probably something that you don't get asked often, either in these interviews or in meetings with prospective clients, but what's the biggest thing you want someone to take away from this interview and have, like, if it's one sentence or two sentences imprinted in their mind?
For me, like, I think the most important thing is like I don't focus on piles of cash. I focus on like streams of income. Like that's me. I know I said it in another podcast recently. I also think that the best time to invest is when you can afford to invest. I also think that the more knowledge you have reduces the risk of investing. I think that the way that society is programmed and the way that we're programmed working at a job, even if you've got a grading, I mean, even if you're earning 80 grand a year, yeah, you earn 80 grand a year, 17 goes to tax, so you're at 63, 25 to live, so you're at like, I don't know, okay, I'm losing my track, but I don't know, maybe 47, I don't know. And then like, you know, you've got to like, you want to go on a holiday, like that might cost 10 grand, like you want to like just buy like regular shit. Like at the end of the year, you got 20 grand left, yeah? So like, 20 grand, like you times that by 10, you got 200K after 10 years. What's 200K going to be after 10 years? Like, probably not much with inflation. Where's the property prices going to be? Probably a lot higher. Is your current like income going to follow like CPI and continue to go up? Probably not. So like, I think like the way that like we're all programmed, like we're all kind of fucked. Like that's what we, like everyone has to realize. Like the normal thing that we're doing is like probably not going to get you where you want to be.
Mm.
Or you're just going to like retire at like, you know, 60, when you get the pension, which is like 67 or something. They're trying to phase that out. So I don't think anybody is really excited for that. And it's okay if like you're enjoying your day to day. Like if you're loving your day to day and you love working and all that stuff, like that's great. Like, but for me, like I didn't love what I was doing. And I do really enjoy what I'm doing now. But like at the same time, like I would love to do what I'm doing, but also like be on a beach somewhere and like get a tan and like be in Europe, like, you know, and for me, like it's delayed gratification, it's sacrifice, it's working hard. So, I mean, I think like you're going to work anyway, so you might as well like try and put your money to work.
Mm.
And that doesn't have to be in property. That can be in whatever. But I think that...
doing that is the important thing.
Exactly. And I mean, our grandparents did it. I mean, our grandparents, like they didn't like they would have, like, they came here and their whole life was for their kids and the kids would work and everybody, like they knew hard work. I mean, I feel like we're pussies. Like we don't work anywhere near as hard as they worked. Like we have it too good.
Yeah, unless you came from a family that was used to that, which is always interesting.
Exactly. Right. I didn't have it easy, but I definitely like people have had it way harder than I have.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Let's wrap with our rapid fire questions.
Do it.
Now I'm just trying to think back to what we originally had. So, what's in the fridge at home?
Lots of meat and lots of Yakult milks.
You're cool. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Lauren's really into that. I don't get it. It's fucking weird. I don't get the taste, man. Yeah. It's the sweetness of it.
And mandarines as well. I just love mandarines. Like,
okay.
On the go. I don't know.
And if you were to recommend a podcast, doc, or a movie to the audience?
For me at the moment, I'm on like a lot of... I'm on Jordan Peterson a bit at the moment. Like I love him. I love his perspective. What else? David Goggins is very good. Yeah, there's some good ones.
Have you come across the meme that is Andrew Tate of late?
Oh, yes.
He's a weird motherfucker.
He's funny, isn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's been interesting for me watching a lot of comedy podcasts and managing comedy talent and that he appeared as a bit of a meme on...
Yeah.
One podcast a show and has now turned into like a real viral sensation where people kind of take him seriously. But the best bit is like I watch clips at the moment of him breaking character because it's quite the character.
Oh, really? Yeah.
So there's like clips of him doing live streams and he's just breaking character. It's hilarious.
Really? What do you mean? What's he saying?
Like he's just...
a normal dude sort of thing.
Yeah, he knows that the person is...
like fictitious.
So what it was, the first one I noticed, first clip was when he was on Your Mum's House podcast, which is a big comedy podcast, and he was saying like something ludicrous, like women are your property.
Yeah.
Or like women are stupid or something like that.
Yeah.
And then the host like makes it even worse. He like doubles down on it. Like, we should own women or there should be like a law to own women. And he's like... He's like pausing, like, because he doesn't know what to do.
He doesn't know if he should double down or like, not.
And he's kind of like smiling, like,
yeah.
And so it's like almost that comedian has like broken his. There's many cases like that.
Which I haven't seen it.
It's funny for me because being in the TikTok space, everyone's furious about him. But I've just realized that the guy is a character built to sell this, you know, self-improvement stuff that he's saying. Just fascinating.
See, I haven't seen it. I've seen a lot of his general stuff.
Yeah.
Because it's just like, but I don't like look into it and stuff.
Yeah.
But he's everywhere. I mean,
he's everywhere.
Everywhere. Yeah.
It's funny because in 6 months, won't be.
Yeah. Yeah. My girlfriend sees him. How the fuck do you know him? But
Yeah,
I guess he's on everybody's. Yeah.
It's hilarious.
Yeah.
Bo, thank you for coming in. Where can people find you on the interwebs?
I mean, I'm on Instagram. We have a company TikTok. And
that's right, I've seen that.
Yeah, good fun.
And what's the website?
Maplegroup.com.au.
Okay, we'll make sure all of that's linked. But, bro, thanks for coming in.
Perfect, thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for checking out this episode. If you liked it, do subscribe. And of course, like it on YouTube if you're watching as well. We'd really appreciate that. For audio, if you've not already listening on your podcast app, you can search for it on any good app, including Spotify, Pocket Casts, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, etc. For video, if you're not watching, you can search Uncommon Podcast on YouTube. It's the first one that appears every single time. For behind the scenes, do follow us on Instagram and TikTok. It's @uncommon_show. But until next time, thanks for tuning in.